All right, welcome back, everybody. We have six great guests with us here today on the program. We're talking about Kemet and, of course, the upcoming event, the tour, Superior Technologies and Consciousness of the Ancients Tour. Really fascinating stuff. And, of course, it's always difficult to get into it when we have six different voices with us and really get into detail about all this, of course. But we are here to bring your attention to what they're doing and give you a little bit of an overview of some of the areas, of course, that they individually touch upon and what happens, I guess, when we bring all this together. A really interesting mix. And why don't we begin with you again, Stephen, and talk a little bit more about actually what Kemetology is. For those who haven't even heard the name before, they're not associated with that. There's some interesting basic stuff here we can run through, I guess.
Excellent. Thank you, Henrik. Yes, actually, it's the title itself, Kemet, Kemetology. Why opposed to Egyptology? Well, we say that the word Egypt, of course, is not an indigenous word. It comes from a Greek term, Egyptos, which comes from a term that actually Hakim differs from a lot of other Egyptologists or historians who talk about it. A lot of them say that the word Egyptos comes from the town of Koptos, where Christianity actually began in Egypt, the Copts. The Coptic Christians, but Hakim had a different teaching. He talked about a stele, which is a stone which has writings on it, in the site of Memphis, which the ancient term was Menefer, a stele of a priest. And on there is a term in the ancient language, Het Ka Ptah. Het means place. Now, Ka is a word that we could actually have a long discussion of. We describe it as the physical projection, like the personality, the double. And Ptah will, for the purpose of discussion here, will say is just a creator god, one of the netters, a male netter, a male principle of generation. So the term actually meant the place where the image of the god of Ptah manifested. And that was only one area, which is that, again, was Memphis or Menefer. That became Het Ka Ptah, Higit Ptos in Egypt, Egyptos. And that's where the word Egypt comes from. So it was only relating to one area, one site. The ancients called their civilization Kemet. Now, to understand, as people who study the hieroglyphs, usually the glyphs are only just, they're not actually, I have to go into more detail about this, but the glyphs usually are just consonants. There were no glyphs for vowels. So we see the three symbols, which later became K-M-T, and that was the symbol of the civilization, so we say Kemet. We put in the vowels. I spelled it K-H-E-M-I-T. Many people have spelled it different ways, K-M-E-T. It's the sound that's important, not the spelling. So we use it to say that this was the term for the whole civilization. It meant the black land. It referred to the rich, dark, alluvial, fertile soil that the Nile should use to deposit every summer the flooding, which is what was something that they looked for in the temples. They actually predicted it because it was the harvest. It would be able to show what was going to be the harvest. So they're talking about the black land, the basis of civilization. That was the civilization, Kemet, Kemet. So that's why we teach Kemetology, not Egyptology. And the basis that Hakim gave us was the concept of cycles, to differentiate from the idea of Darwinian evolution, particularly linear evolution, that everything goes in a straight line from the primitive to the complex. Well, that goes in the flies in the face of everything that's in nature. Everything that we observe in nature is natural cycles. Everything is cyclical, returning and coming, returning and coming. The Kemetians understood that. So they created their system based on cycles, five stages of the sun. They used the daily movement of the sun in the sky to represent five great stages. These stages represented stages of our history, our evolution, and our consciousness. First one was Kheper, which is the scarab beetle, which was known as the driller, represent the adolescent stage, the birth, dawn, the very birth of consciousness. Second stage is Ra, and immediately people will say, well, wait a minute, isn't Ra the sun god? Well, we usually say, no, thanks for playing. It's only one-fifth of this understanding. Ra is the sun at noon, the sun at the highest heat, the heat of the day, and it represents the adolescent stage of consciousness. And Ra was known as the stubborn, usually depicted by a ram, which to the ancient people was the stubborn animal before a donkey. Third stage is Un, usually depicted by a mature man standing upright. It's called the wise. It is the sun as it appears in the early afternoon, the heat of the sun, powerful. It's when we've achieved a level of understanding, consciousness, we're mature. Fourth stage is Aten. Aten means the wiser. It's usually an old man on a staff. It's usually the sun at the peak, highest peak of the day. It is when we've at our height, when we're at our maximum as far as consciousness. And so the last stage, Amen or Imen, means night, dark, or the hidden. No image, only meant darkness, and we're in separation then. So then we're usually, when I give a lecture on this, I stop and ask the audience, what stage of the five do you think we're in now? Most people now can answer, if it's usually an aware audience, most people don't know. We're in the fifth stage. Hakim is teaching us, for the last 5,000 plus years, we've been in a stage of darkness, in a stage of separation, the low end of the cycle. Mm. We're coming into dawn now. This was the reason for his teaching, the reason for passing the teachings to me, to anybody, to bring it to the West, is because he was convinced we're entering in the dawn, new phase. And in other words, we're looking at a total cycle from Kepler to now of 65,000 years. So he was telling us there was advanced civilization on the Giza Plateau in what we call Kempt 65,000 years ago. When they came into dawn, they came into consciousness. And we've now gone full cycle. This corresponds with the Mayan teachings, Aztec teachings, Incan teachings, all indigenous teachings all around the planet. We've come to the end of a major phase. We're now in a new dawn. Hakim called it the awakening. And that's what he was, his reason, his raison d'etre for teaching, for doing this now, was to prepare people for the awakening. He left that mission to us to continue the awakening and the preparation. So it is a question of cycles, and it is much more important for people to understand that, as well as anything, that everything exists in cycles. In Hakim's teaching, there was no Big Bang. There was no beginning, no end. Only interminable cycles that we continue, spiraling upward. Think of a spiral as the image of this cycle, spiraling upward. And so the importance is we're now in Kheper again. We're now approaching a new dawn, a new birth, why we're all doing this, why we're all gathering together to do these teachings, why there is a new age, why there is people coming to consciousness all around the world. It explains the Arab Spring. It explains everything that's happening around the planet as far as consciousness, gay consciousness, women's rights all around the world now, particularly in Egypt, in Muslim countries. This is the awakening.
65,000 years, he said, Stephen. So the consciousness driven cycle you're talking about here, this has to do with the ability basically for mankind to achieve the monuments and the understanding that they did of ancient Kemet, as you've been talking about, ancient Kemet. But this then is completely driven by the cycles. This is we are well, quote unquote, we're slaves to the cycles. Is that how
and
we
excellent.
Can say?
And that brings in the understanding of Netter. Hakim defined Netter differently than anyone else. The first one to redefine the title was the French mathematician R. A. Schwalla de Lubitsch. If you've ever interviewed John Anthony West, John Anthony West is the most outstanding proponent of Schwalla's teaching. Schwalla was the first one who questioned the definition of Netter, meaning God or goddess, deity. Mm-hmm. He said, no, it was an aspect of the whole. It's not the whole. Hakim took it to a further level. He said, it's senses. He said, we are innately born with 360 senses. 180 we label feminine, 180 we label masculine, coming to 360. They are the gods and goddesses of Egypt, but they were not deity in the understanding that we understand God. They were not complete. They were aspects of the whole. So Hakim would teach us that in the previous cycle, in the age of Aten, 20,000 years ago, where I put it, we were using all 360 senses. We were in the highest state of consciousness. It was then that we, and I say we, built pyramids. So this is the understanding that people have to have. Not only did they have this engineering, Chris Dunn will be in the field. He will show everyone this magnificent understanding of engineering, manufacturing, but understand that they were also, we were also in the highest state of consciousness to be able to do the things that we're going to see. So that's why we say spiritual machines. And again, we're talking about a previous cycle to the one we were now, when most of this that we're going to show people was done over 10,000 years ago.
Yeah. Chris, what Stephen is talking about here has also to do very much with the experience that one can have in the temples. Is this something that one can sense when we go there? And if you agree with Stephen on this point with the cycles and all this, is it becoming more and more obvious, I guess, to people visiting that this is what's happening, this is what's going on, if it's a cycle-driven thing and people are, well, effectively then waking up to the reality of this, if our consciousness is blooming, maybe then we can fully understand more, at least, what the temple is about. What do you think, Chris?
I completely agree with the concept of a cyclical history where civilizations rise and fall, and I definitely agree with pushing back the timeline much further back into prehistory for the creation of the pyramids. As far as the exact dates, I have no argument. If somebody says it's 36,000 years or 64,000 years, there's no argument from me, because what I see when I go through Egypt and also in Peru is the existence of a civilization, and the only thing that we get to see are the products of their brilliance and their genius. In Peru, we find very, very precise artifacts. Also in Bolivia, some really complex geometry. No tools to explain them. Same in Egypt, even more complex, more sophisticated objects and artifacts and constructions. And even the simple geometries that we look at in the Serapeum pale in comparison when you go and look at the temples and examine some of the statues, because what I found and what really excited me and inspired me was that the simple geometries such as flat surfaces, square boxes, and things of that nature, what we find with the Ramses statue is a very complex three-dimensional surfaces that are precisely machined and precise and symmetrical from one side of the statue to the other. And it's sheer genius when you look at the tools that they must have developed in order to create these. But the effect of the temples, too, that was when I first started to really key into the spiritual nature of the ancient Kemetians and what they constructed in the temples, because they were acoustic engineers, and to think that they would not develop their acoustic science and execute that science and technology, or manifested in the temples, and just do so at the pyramids is incorrect, because each of the temples has its own particular resonance and tone to it, and it really does affect people who walk within the colonnades and look at the magnificent columns in the hypostyle halls at Luxor, at Karnak, at Dendera, which is inspiring. I spent a whole day at Dendera and examining the hypostyle hall there, and there is a chapter in my book on that. And it's an amazing, amazing sight. But just spending six hours or so inside one of the temples, it affects you more than a brief half hour or 1 hour visit, which is what most visitors usually get. You really become affected by them and drawn into them. It's quite an educational experience.
Wow, really interesting. One of the most mesmerizing things must be the unfinished obelisk at the Aswan Quarry, if one can comprehend, obviously, what we're really looking at. Tell us about this, Chris.
Well, the unfinished obelisk at Aswan is has been a source of speculation and controversy for many years. And people have tried to explain how the ancient Egyptians were able to quarry granite and create obelisks. Their theories, the conventional theories, they used the dolerite hammers to pound out the granite. Another chapter in my book also deals with the unfinished obelisk and how the theories just don't hang together because of the constraints that the ancient workers were faced with. And also they misread the tool marks on the obelisks. And what we'll look at when we're out in the field in April, we'll look at those tool marks and discuss the possible more advanced ways that the ancient Kemetians were doing their quarrying. Certainly not with dolerite pounders. Those were introduced much later, and really the mystery about the unfinished obelisk is, why do they leave it unfinished? And I think if we ask that question, we can pinpoint, if we could just date the time when they stopped working on the unfinished obelisk, we could probably fix the date when the cataclysm happened and that civilization was destroyed, and much of the material that supported the civilization was destroyed. Because what we look at from ancient Egypt is just the skeleton of that civilization. You know, what did the clothing look like, the flesh and blood? What other ancillary industries were supported that civilization? And I look at it similar to our civilization, when we have no problem talking about the potential for destruction of our current civilization and what would happen after that destruction by a cataclysm. And we see our material goods would disappear over a period of time. And so we have to assume that much of the technology and the tools that were used to cut the stone disappeared over time. And that's, I believe, a very reasonable explanation, unless they are hidden under the sand somewhere out in the desert. We don't know.
And they could be?
And they could be, but they haven't been found yet. And the problem is with the controversy now is that we have a growing number of technologists, engineers, scientists, machinists, toolmakers, who travel to Egypt and are commenting on the impossibility of creating those artifacts using the tools that are in the ancient Egyptian toolbox. But Egyptologists and archaeologists do not take their speculations that far. They stay with what they've been able to find in the archaeological record.
Right.
And unfortunately, that doesn't explain many of the amazing artifacts that I've found there, such as Abu Rawash. There is a stone at Abu Rawash, a granite slab, and it shows clear evidence. It's hard evidence, clear, that stone was cut with a 37-foot diameter tool. I mean, a saw that was rotating, 37 feet diameter. And the marks are left in the stone. You can actually see the grinding marks. And there is a photograph on my website of that particular stone. So all of this evidence is stacking up to say, you know, the conventional theories do not work anymore. They are rejected by those who are knowledgeable in technology, and those people are growing in number, and we find them joining our tours and appreciating what they see, and adding their own comments and thoughts and their own ingenuity in trying to come up with answers. These tours are very, very educational for all of us. I really enjoy them, and I really enjoy spending time with the guests. We have some fantastic guests who join these tours, and we just have a wonderful, beautiful sharing time.
Excellent. Patricia and Yusuf, let's turn your mic back on and bring you back into the conversation, because I wanted to ask either one of you a little bit what Stephen talked about when it comes to the tool use in Kemet, how potentially, if there's anything in the tradition about how this was done, basically.
Yeah. Well, everything reflects, like the unfinished obelisk site. You can see not less than three different types of machining in that site. Two of them can be accomplished by today's tools, I would say, or like not the advanced technology, but one of them is like marks that we are not aware what kind of tools will cause it. The patterns, like a spiraling frequency going through the stone and forming steps. Not just that, there is also shafts in the quarry. It's so deep and so narrow that there is no space for anybody to be in it using any tool of any kind. They're so narrow and so deep. So we wonder, the only, not the only, but like one of the things my father mentioned was the biosonic cut. This is what he would like see through this kind of machining, that there had to be some kind of energy beamed at the stone to alter it in order to transform it or to shape it.
Wow, interesting. Now, what about the tunnel network, if we just talk about that a little bit? It seems like the Giza Plateau has kind of a natural, well, Swiss cheese type of a property to it, but that there also has been a lot of carvings throughout the entire plateau, and this slowly, maybe throughout hundreds or thousands of years, a network of tunnels have been built, basically. How much of this has been mapped so far? It's been somewhat of a controversy, I guess, in terms of what actually has been able to be accessed, how much it is, and it's been one Sai Hawass was in charge. A lot of it was closed off and everything, but what do we know, Patricia or Yusuf, about the tunnel network today?
Yeah. Many of the doors were closed before Sai Hawass. And there are unlimited amount, and this is the part that's mapped is only a very small part on the surface, but it was never really excavated and the real map for it. But you can see parts of it that's accessible, like one of the parts known as the Osirian shaft, which exists between the Valley Temple beside the Sphinx and the Middle Pyramid. There's something called the Causeway, which is originally a tunnel. This tunnel had a shaft, it had a well. The well is around 100 feet deep, and it connects to three levels of chambers. The first chamber is empty. Perhaps it had a box and it's quarried or taken away. And the second level has five rooms with granite boxes in them. And then the third chamber has a shrine or four pillars and a basin with a box in it, or like a pit with a box in it, but it's filled with water. So this is one of the examples, one of the good examples to tell us about the design, that it goes for at least three levels underneath the ground. It can be more than that, but there is water that doesn't allow anybody to go further. And there is tunnels and shafts, so either horizontal and vertical, and chambers also. And the chambers are also, some of has the more shafts in them. It's, some of them are huge and some of them are narrow. It's really, also part of it is constructed. Like part of the Giza Plateau, there is part of the mound that was built and then they carved the tunnels in it, which means that they had like a clear vision of what design they wanted to accomplish, to continue part of the mound by constructing it from stone and then carve the shafts in them. And you can find that the shafts are connecting with each other in a very complicated way, and it goes deep underground, that if you are not if you don't have a good source for light, it's going to be very, very, very dark down there. Yeah. Also, manufacturing it, how are you going to take all the stones that you break out from underneath to the surface again, or bring the boxes down? Mm-hmm. Everything seems to be very, very impossible, but yet it's there to challenge us to understand how it was made.
Yeah, I heard a while back that there was allegedly no soot in some of the places where there have been carvings made or something like that, and I think that was at Giza too, and allegedly they could then tell that, okay, they didn't have any fire in there to be able to see on the walls, which might be a clue that there was some kind of other organic technology used that you said before, like we know that there's bioluminescence, but there might be a number of other ways that they were capable of producing light, basically. Have Patricia or Yusuf, have you guys heard about this?
Yeah, we've heard about many of the theories, and again, I like to question. We look at these things and technologies from our three-dimensional cultural perspective. And it's really hard to imagine that a culture that had 360 senses, this higher sensibility, what they might have been able to create or even were capable of doing, even in the darkness, through frequency alone.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's very interesting. Maybe there's an ability to see in the dark or ultraviolet vision senses. If there's so many senses, anything is possible, right?
Yes.
But the explanation about lots of these shafts, especially the ones that's inside pyramids, when they say that it was made originally to mislead tomb raiders. So, like, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. Egyptologists, they have everything figured out. Ask him what's cracking the hole, he will come up with something and give you an answer. But so it's like,
yeah, it's funny.
That's a problem. They don't leave any part of the cup empty to be ready to be filled. They have everything figured out, and we see more question marks than answers in Egyptology.
Sure. Oh, definitely. That's right.
Yes.
Well, that's good. I want to tie Brian back into this as well and ask you a little bit about this. There have been so many researchers that have talked about Egypt and South America or Mesoamerica and those cultures of being basically the one and the same, or at least through transcultural diffusion, they have, they're cousins to each other, if you will, or brothers and sisters. But this will be an attempt for you, obviously, to do a somewhat of a fair comparison of the different cultures and look at the base constructions of some of the sites and just see the similarities.
Well, definitely. And what we're seeing more and more, I was just actually with Robert Schock, the man who redated the Sphinx. He was here in November, and we took him to Pumapunku and Tiwanaku in Bolivia, as well as Easter Island. And from his recent book, as well as the work of other brilliant researchers such as Barbara Haddon Clough and Graham Hancock, etc., what we're looking at is that there definitely was a global high civilization or groups of civilizations existing prior to the end of the Ice Age. And that when the Ice Age ended, it was very traumatic, very destructive on a planetary level. And so what we see now is we see evidence of these different civilizations existing 10, 12 or more thousand years ago, and the only remains that we can find at the moment are the stone megalithic structures. The tools, as Chris was saying, it's difficult to find much evidence of the tools themselves, but these people in various parts of the world had levels of technology beyond what we have, not simply comparable, but vibrational technologies that are the things of science fiction to us. And that's what some people have a real problem with, because automatically there are presumptions that lasers were used. And Chris Dunn has been able to easily disprove the idea that lasers were necessarily used to a great extent and in ancient times, but some other forms of vibrational ultrasonic technology were at work, most likely in Peru, Bolivia, Egypt, and possibly other lands as well. And so what excites me is that I'll be able to compare what I've spent 6.5 years staring at on a daily basis, because actually I'm right now I'm speaking from my apartment, which is 2 blocks from the most sacred and most sophisticated building in the Americas, I believe, called the Coricancha. And so it'll be a great time for me to be able to compare what I've seen here with what these brilliant people have been experiencing in Egypt. And we're also working collectively, which is great, because in the past, there have been many researchers who have worked independent of one another and not sharing their knowledge. But what I love about Chris and Stephen and Gary and the Awans is that they're very sharing people. And as a group, we're trying to solve the riddle of who we were and where we came from, the ultimate question of humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an exciting one, definitely. And it feels like there's a lot of different puzzle pieces that are actually falling into place at this time. And indeed, if it's true what Stephen said earlier about the properties of the time being right, then certainly more now than ever. And on top of that, then perhaps even more of the political changes, hopefully that will yield an even better outcome in Egypt with tourism and everything else. And but maybe this kind of that it's died back a little bit with tourism, as you said in the beginning, Patricia. Maybe that's really a good thing then, because less people there means that researchers like yourself and those who have alternative ideas can actually have time to visit the sites for longer periods. You can really check them out. You might be able to go places you haven't before. So yeah, it's an interesting period for sure.
Some of the sites we'll be seeing in and around Giza, of course, the Giza Plateau. We also go to Saqqara and Dendera. Saqqara and Dahshur, the place of the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid. We'll be going to the museum, of course, the Egyptian Museum. And a highlight will be a late afternoon trip to Abu Sir and Abu Jarab. We'll be going south, and we'll be going, we'll have a five-star cruise, of course. We'll be seeing sites in and around Luxor, Karnak, Luxor Temple. We'll be going to Dendera and Abydos, and, of course, the Valley of the Kings, the Museum, Medinet Habu,
Hatshepsut.
If we want to, pretty much anything we want to do while we're there. And then we'll be taking the cruise south to Aswan, where we'll be going to Philae, the Temple of Isis, as well as Elephantine Island. And
on the way to Aswan, we're going to be stopping a couple of times to see the Temple of Sobek in Kumumbu,
mm-hmm.
And the Temple of Horus in Edfu. And we usually take the bus to go visit Dendera and Abydos and see the Osirian, which is a very, very interesting site in Abydos. It's behind it. All constructed from quartzite and rose granite. Also reflects high-tech machining and huge pillars, megalithic ones. And that's the site famous for the Flower of Life painted on the walls. And also, we're going to be seeing Elephantine Island, which is a very, very interesting site. Contains a device with no writings at all. All made from rose granite or red granite. And we including one of the sites that most of the tours doesn't go to, which is Fayoum. Mm. There are three pyramid sites there. Two are related to the Middle Kingdom, and one that's related to the Old Kingdom. And this line times, of course, are based on writings. We believe that they all existed to produce or to be active as houses of nature or perimeter.
Mm.
And Fayoum is one of the very interesting areas in Egypt. And the pyramids that's related to the Middle Kingdom, they have big part of them is constructed using mud bricks and then cased with limestones. So those who analyze these pyramids think the Middle Kingdom, like kings or pharaohs, they choose the cheap labor and cheap material. And this is not true in any way, because these sites contain very, very, very special types of stones and the designs, especially in Lahoun and Hawara, the most famous mud brick pyramids in Fayoum. We can see very clear evidence in Lahoun about how the shafts are part of the same complex with the pyramid. They're connected and running through right under the pyramid through two tunnels and chambers made from rose granite, and the one in Hawara, which also contained a temple front of it, famous as the Labyrinth. This temple was all quarried by the Roman Empire, but the historians tell us about it, how it contained more than or like around 3,000 chambers of resonance, that they just by opening a door, a sound like thunder will be amplified inside. And how a complex like this can feed the pyramid with all the frequencies it needs.
Oh, interesting.
Not to mention that the core or the focal chamber in this mud brick pyramid was made of a one single solid piece of stone called yellow transparent quartzite, and it's a huge chamber weight after it's carved from the inside, over 110 tons. So I don't know why you're going to think this is cheap, because it's put in the mud brick pyramid. I think it's very, very hard to find a piece of transparent quartzite that megalithic and to cut it and house it in the middle of the limestone mound, same like others. All what I believe is the mud brick had another purpose, because when we find different designs for the pyramids, we can think only of different results, that if I'm using these elements and a different design, I will get a different result. Same like the types of energies we are aware of today, like electricity. We know electricity, but we run with it different kinds of machines.
Hmm. Very interesting. The sound and the resonance aspect as well to all of this, Yusuf. Do we know why this was one of the main, I guess, tenets that they wanted to achieve? Health purposes, alter consciousness as a amplification? What was it used for, do you think?
Sound is, in my opinion, sound is the fifth element inside air and water and fire. So the power of sound can be activating lots of things, and activating especially alchemy formulas. And we're talking about the alchemy of nature, how you use the alchemy in nature itself, like how the crystal forms by the alchemy of nature, changing the atom of the stone and the fire formation of crystals. Or the white calcite, which is also another type of crystal from limestone that's built up from water on earth, and also interacts with electric field on the side. So everything is connected, but some of the sites were neglected, used as quarries. So we gather pieces of the puzzle from each site and try to put them together in order to have a bigger picture about how the whole site looked like.
Stephen, isn't that interesting? I wanted to ask you about this, that we, when it's being interpreted, all these monuments and the usage and everything, we're looking at it with a, well, first of all, we don't know, we have a limited consciousness, but we assume that it must be for the reasons that we think about today. And really, there's no way out of that thinking, really, at least not for the Egyptologist.
Anthropomorphizing is the official term.
Right.
Actually looking at it with a 20th, 21st century eye and putting a 20th or 21st, even 19th century when Egyptology began, putting that mindset on. I would just like to add a little more of what Yusuf was brilliantly saying. And this is one of the great things about the wonderful itinerary that Patricia and Gary have created. Going to these so-called Middle Kingdom sites, most groups don't go there. In fact, when last April, when Patricia and Yusuf took me, I had never been to Harada and Lahun myself, been to Maidum with Hakim and Fayum, but it was Yusuf who convinced me that these are not Middle Kingdom pyramids. They are assumed, because they're mud brick, that they're entirely mud brick. Not so. As Yusuf mentioned, we can see a limestone structure. In other words, a mud brick was used like as an insulation layer, perhaps as a conducting layer for different type of vibratory effects than the other pyramids, which had insulation layers of limestone, granite, basalt. Now, what's key that we look for, with Yusuf has determined in the field, we look for three specific stones, which is the key to us of ancient Kemet. And those stones are rose quartz granite, and the rose granite in Egypt is some of the highest crystalline granite in the world. I am working with a wonderful scientist named Dr. George Bayer. He is a chemist as well as materials engineer. He's been doing testing of the stones of Egypt for me. We just recently tested some of the rose quartz granite. It's anywhere between 40% to 55% crystal, highest crystalline granite in the world. So they chose the stone for its vibratory frequency. Then we also see basalt, and as Yusuf mentioned, calcite, which is called alabaster, the Italian term. Mm-hmm. All highly crystalline stones, highly vibratory, obviously chosen for their vibratory qualities. When we see those three stones, we see ancient Kemet, as we say, pre-Ice Age. These are the stones of ancient Kemet. We see that at all the sites. So it was Yusuf who convinced me beyond all doubt that these are not Middle Kingdom sites, that these, again, are transformed sites. They go back to ancient times. What Kemet was well over 10,000 years ago. There were pyramids and temples all over Kemet. We talk about Buwizer, the land of Osiris, as 25 square miles from Abu Wash in the north, which Christopher has mentioned, to Dashur in the south. Also includes Giza, Saqqara, Abu Jurab, Abu Sir, Azari at El Awiyan, and those are the sites which Hakim called Bu Wizard, Bu Land, Wizard, the original name for Osiris, the land of Osiris. He said this was the oldest area in all of Kemet, known, characterized by its pyramids and temples, and connected by underground tunnels. What were the tunnels for? The tunnels, according to Hakim, were built to bring water to the sites. That water was the source of the energy. Water and sound were the two things Hakim, well, as soon as I met him, and particularly in 1997, where he determined that I was going to be the student that he was going to work with, and he went into the extreme detail, which became my first book, Land of Osiris, he wanted me to concentrate on water and sound, and the interplay of both, and the knowledge that the ancients had. And again, we cannot look at this with a 21st century mindset. We have to understand that these people, as Patricia noted, existing in 360 degrees of consciousness, were in a much different state than we are today. And as she also alluded to, may have been working on multidimensional levels, not just third dimension. As she said, we don't look at the sites as a third dimensional thing, as fourth dimension, fifth dimension, and higher. We believe that these people were interdimensionally connecting with other consciousness, not just extraterrestrial physical beings, but consciousness that doesn't have physical form. Now, I know we may be going over the top here, but we're talking about the fact that these were interdimensional sites, and it can be experienced. However, the sites are geared to have the experience that Patricia said, that Gary said, to open the senses. Each site, as determined by the energy it is, each netter is a specific energy. Each site dedicated to a specific netter is dedicated to that specific frequency of sound, that energy. We connect with that energy when we're at the site, whatever we do, ceremonies, whatever we do, chanting, just meditating, opening up to that energy, it opens the netter within us. So it isn't as above, so below. As Hakim taught us, nothing exists outside that's not inside. In a wonderful video that I brought to Egypt last April of an interview we did in 1992 in front of the Mena House, myself, Hakim, and John Anthony West. Hakim was asked about this, the netters, what do they mean? And he would said, he was trying to address the fact that people think did not understand him. So he said, don't call me pagan. He said, I'm not pagan. He said, we are the other halves of God. Then he said a statement that both Yusuf and I love, and we both almost cried when we heard it. I cry every time I still hear it. He said, we are the nerves of God, meaning and understanding nerves, neurology, receiving and transmitting. We are the other half of God. In other words, there is no God outside if there's not God inside. This is why he taught the netters are in us. The whole objective of what we do is to awaken these netters within us. Each site does that with what we do at each site. And that's why Gary has said, Christopher has said, we've all said, people have these incredible experiences when they go to the sites. Unconsciously or consciously, it's opening up that netter within, that energy, that consciousness, that awareness. And sometimes people can freak out, or sometimes people can have the understanding. We know that we're there to help people, to guide them through the experience. We know that that's going to happen. So we expect people to have these types of experiences. But that's what we mean by life-altering, life-changing experience, because it is awakening. It is the awakening to awaken that netter within us. The sights are geared to do that. And the water was brought to the sites for the energy for the pyramids, for the energy of the production. The sound was used for everything we can conceive of. In fact, Christopher Dunn has been working with a brilliant physicist at the University of Illinois, Dustin Carr. He's actually, his specialty in physics is acoustics. He has made the statement that whoever built the Great Pyramid, he doesn't know who, but whoever made the Great Pyramid had a knowledge of nonlinear acoustics we only approach today. So we're talking about an advanced science of acoustics, sound technology that cut, shaped the stone, produced anti-gravity fields so that they could lift the stone, everything we could think of. And the sound, this was a civilization constantly bathed in infrasound, kept the immune systems at the highest. We believe this is the source of the patriarchs of the Old Testament, that people lived for hundreds of years because they were not susceptible to viruses, bacteria, and diseases as we are today, sound, keeping the immune systems at the highest functioning state.
Fascinating. Incredibly interesting. What do you think happened, Stephen? Why did consequent civilizations move? Did it transform slowly, do you think? Or was there a cataclysm?
Well, we're talking about a cataclysm. We do all, we're looking at several different theories that around the years, between 11,000 to 14,000 years ago, there seemed to be some major events that happened across the Earth, worldwide cataclysmic. The actual origin is speculative. Some people say it was a supernova. Robert Schock is very high on the idea that it was extreme solar activity, extreme solar flares, comets, meteorites, something happened. But there was extreme activity which made these so-called advanced civilizations seem to vanish. It's the idea of Plato's Atlantis disappearing one night under the seas. It wasn't one night. We think it was thousands of years,
yeah.
But it is the disappearance. And again, the important thing Hakim taught us is that no one is to blame. We're always talking about, oh, the Atlanteans did something wrong. They abused their technology. We abused our knowledge. That may be true, but Hakim said it was the natural cycle. It's the natural. We had a cusp between the end of the age of Aten to the age of Amun, which begins around 3100 BCE. There is a couple thousand years of cusp. We can see this. It's what Barbara Hand Clow calls in the archaeological record the blank.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of evidence. Apparently, we started all over again. We went from advanced civilization to then basically living in huts and caves and starting over again.
Yeah.
And that's what you see. This is why the Egyptologists cannot explain why Egyptian civilization appears out of nowhere. As Yusuf said, it goes to Old Kingdom, but before Old Kingdom, we can't see anything. We see people living primitively. How did they suddenly come to start building pyramids, start building temples? Well, they didn't. They inherited what was already there. As Yusuf has said, the transformation of the sites. Ancient Kemet was there. A lot of sites became abandoned after the cataclysm. A lot of things changed. The whole civilization had to change. Their subsistence, their technology changed. But they came back to the sites that were already there and transformed them. That's the Old Kingdom. That's the beginning of what the Egyptologists think was ancient Egypt. It's just the phase that started in Amun 5,000 years ago. That's all Egyptology is the one-fifth of the cycle, Amun.
Yeah, exclusion, lots of exclusion and not taking into consideration. It's fascinating listening to this. I wanted to, when we have you on the line as well, Chris, I wanted to ask you about something, since you're looking at this from the point of view of it as an engineer. What do you think about the reconstructed limestone theory, if there's anything to the geopolymers of Davidovits and others we've talked about with these guys in the past? What do you make of this?
Good question. Thanks. First of all, in the interest of accuracy, I'd like to correct you, Stephen. Dustin Carr was not with the University of Illinois. He was a Cornell grad, but it's a minor point, but in the interest of accuracy, sorry about that.
Thank you, Chris. No problem, Chris.
I always appreciate it.
The geopolymer theory, I became aware of that in 1984 when the pyramids came out. The pyramid solved, I think it was Davidovits and Margie Morris who published a book in the States, and it did receive a lot of attention. My position when I heard it and read the book was that I don't have any problem if there was, if the pyramid was poured stone, then it's poured stone. It's not an issue for me. My question about the validity of that theory was the all the granite artifacts that we see in Egypt and the tool marks that we find on the granite artifacts that seemed to indicate that they had very efficient cutting tools. So it appeared to me that if they had very efficient cutting tools, then and they were able to cut granite so efficiently, they could make short work out of limestone if they wanted to. But having said that, you know, you go on a building site today and you find many different methods of construction when they put a building together. You'll see cutting, joining, poured materials, manufactured materials, and many different elements and methods go into building like a skyscraper or something like that. So to say that only one method was available to the ancient Egyptians, I think would be a mistake. Now, having said that, when we look at the where they took the geopolymer theory to say to exclude all other methods of manufacture, then that is taking it too far. They're not allowing any other methods to the ancient Egyptians. They're not allowing them to have, say, advanced tools because right. their mindset is stuck in this kind of Victorian mindset where we send our scientists and researchers into Egypt, and they're looking at it through these kind of chauvinistic filters and seeing only primitive kind of methods that would have been available to them. And that is our cross to bear in the West, the disservice that we have done to the ancient cultures, to assume that they were primitive because we're looking at history through a linear kind of perspective, where they go from primitive Stone Age people to fairly technically advanced modern people. Now, in my first book, I addressed the geopolymer theory, but not in great detail. I allowed that they may have used that. If that's what they find on the Giza Plateau, they find poured stone, then I don't have a problem with that. But I did dispute that the entire Great Pyramid was built that way, because it appeared that some of the aspects of the building, the technical aspects, are not supported by that particular method. The stones are not uniform, and one would assume that if they were pouring a mixture into a mold, they would use the same mold over and over again. So that kind of dispelled that. And then after my book came out and I was attacked for not accepting the geopolymer theory, or not giving it sufficient study or understanding, mm-hmm. I looked at it further, and I started to look at some of the arguments against it, and there was some articles published in journals that had followed that particular theory and done tests. They took samples from the three larger pyramids on the Giza Plateau. They collected limestone following a chain of custody, took it into the lab, and did an exhaustive analysis of this limestone from the pyramids and compared it to natural limestone, and they found that it was indeed natural limestone. But the geopolymer theory persists, and I think more recently, Professor Barsoom of the Pennsylvania University he came up with the idea that, well, not all the Great Pyramid was a natural limestone. Some of it would have been poured limestone or poured stone. And then we have on the opposite side, you have geologists like Robert Schock, who says that's nonsense. You know, it's natural stone. It's very clear it's natural stone. So, for me right now, it's fairly firm in my mind that the ancient Egyptians, because of their abilities with tools, they were quarrying and cutting natural limestone and granite and constructing their pyramids and temples with it.
Excellent. Now, let's see if we have Gary with us. I want to get you back in here. Patricia and Yusuf very kindly ran through, the sites we wanted to talk about as well. But you were part of picking some of these as well, Gary, right?
Well, the itinerary was designed by Patricia and Yusuf. However, I do have particular favourites. And there's one thing I wanted to throw back to, if you've covered the itinerary in detail, and that was the cycles of consciousness that you touched upon earlier, because I do see that as something that's fundamental to what Red Ice is about. There is a connection between when we talk about a general level of consciousness on the planet and how the cycle of consciousness affects that.
Indeed.
Yeah. I've spoken to Walter Cruttendon, who I helped with the CPAC conference, about this very subject, and it'd be interesting to hear perhaps some of the other speakers' opinion, and that is that we are not locked into some kind of level of consciousness, in that we have, if we take responsibility and educate ourselves, no matter what the general level of consciousness on the planet is, we can raise above that. So it's not this kind of situation where we're powerless, that we do have a power over it. And I would say that anyone that's listening to this interview or has found Red Ice is already doing better than the sort of general level of consciousness, because they're getting into the sort of self-education. We've got these questions about life, and you guys are doing a fantastic job reaching, I guess, tens of millions. I mean, it's a huge impact that you have. And
thank you, Gary.
And that is for me the transition. The old system is this system where we look to a guru. We have a sort of religion where we go to a religious institution. With the state, we look to the state for answers. But the transitioning consciousness happening, as I see it, is we take self-responsibility, our impact on the environment, our impact on others, our self-development. And anyone that's listening to these kind of interviews, I would call that under the self-development area, because they're educating themselves and hopefully becoming wiser as a result. And I've certainly met a lot of your listeners on the tours and at conferences, and they're a well-educated crowd. They've got a lot of questions similar to my own, and we're working together to try and solve some of them.
Well, exactly. It's a really good point, Gary, and thank you for bringing that up. And exactly, you're right. It's all about the interest of having that, you know, drive of wanting to find out, and also doing that for the sake of honesty of what it really is, not for just either sensationalizing the claims or trying to make it more, maybe more than it isn't or whatever, but just have that, you know, continuous drive of finding the answers wherever they may lead. And I think that's definitely one of the main tenets of what we do here, of trying to head in that direction. So thank you for mentioning that, Gary. And before we kind of begin to wrap things up here for this 2 hours we spent together with each and every one of you, I again want to give you some opportunity to either, if there's something specific you want to talk about and get into, and or mention your websites and material again to get into that. And I think we should go kind of around the table as we did before as well. We can begin with you, Stephen, and if there's anything you feel worth mentioning here in the last couple of minutes before we end for this time.
Well, I would just like to quickly add something to what Christopher said. As I mentioned earlier, I am working with Dr. George Baer. We are actually testing stones right now. I have sent him 9 different samples, collected over 4 different trips to Egypt of stone from core blocks of the Great Pyramid, and stones from what we call the Tura limestone, the casing stones. He has tested all 9 samples. All 9 have shown to be natural stone. But this is a reason, as Christopher mentioned, there is an architect, Dr. Marcel Barsoom. He is backing Davidovits and has written some articles. George Baer is preparing to do this. We're going to collect more samples on this tour. Christopher, Gary, Yusuf, Brian will be witnessing to us to have a chain of custody, gathering samples that George will continue to test, and he is preparing to write counter-refuting articles in major journals against Barsoom and Davidovits. That's number one. Mm. And so, number two, I would just really like to end it off to exactly with the theme we're talking to people. This is a unique experience, this tour, to have all of us looking at these sites through our eyes, sharing with the unique people that we always gather on these tours. It's going to be a tremendous experience. And the experience will be that it will be life-changing. There's no doubt about it. The idea is, as we've mentioned, your work in Red Ice, everybody that's doing this today is part of the awakening. This is part of Hakim predicted. He predicted to me 15 years ago what December 21st, 2012 would be, and saying December 23rd would be exactly the same as December 22nd as 21st, that it's not going to be the end. He never predicted that. He predicted the end of these cycles now for the awakening. And so this is why people are called. Gary gets people all the time. Patricia gets people all the time that have been waiting all their lives to go to Egypt. They've had it since, as for me, it was 8 years old when I became fascinated with Egypt and it became my life. Many people feel that way and they feel called to go there. Why people are gathering at all these different, why Brian has so many people coming to Peru, Bolivia. We're getting called to these energy centers now. These energy centers activate the energies within us. It is time. So this is why people are gathering throughout the planet to do these things. It continues past 2012, on and on and on, and it will continue as we bring in the awakening. And that's part of what this major tour is. We all love to share. We love to see the experiences that people have, and we're there for everyone to give them what they need and what they want. And this is truly, truly, believe me, I've been involved with tours for 20 years. This is going to be a very, very unique experience.
Really good. By the way, Gary, are you, I know this will be very extremely difficult, of course, but any plans of filming anything of this?
We are in discussions, and I'm sure Brian will definitely be making some of his videos. He's always fantastic at that. So that we will try and get something on Brian's YouTube channel and anything else.
All right. Well, that's good. For those who don't have the capability of attending, of course, always interesting to see if there's any production. But of course, it's very difficult. You would have to have a whole separate team with you if you wanted to film all this and everything. But no, but that's good. So some additions might occur then on YouTube and everything else. Chris, let's turn to you as well and see if there's anything you want to add in the discussion last couple of minutes.
Yes, thank you. I'll be bringing some tools with me, and the guests will get to handle them themselves. I'll even teach them how to use them. I have done that when I've been to Peru with the guests, and that's what I plan on doing in Egypt. And it will be a unique experience because both Brian and I will be able to share some of our insights into Peru and Bolivia. So the guests will get a perspective from both sides of the Atlantic. It's going to be a great tour. I mean, I am really looking forward to it. And the warmth and friendliness of the Egyptian people is unsurpassed anywhere in the world. It is a very energetic country. People will definitely tune in to a higher vibration while they're there, and they will definitely enjoy themselves. For me, it's all about the guests. It's all about their comfort level, what they're making them happy. They are the people who make the tour happen. Without them, it wouldn't go. So it's all about the guests for me. It's not about making a production or filming or anything like that. If there's any filming, it can't intrude on the guest comfort. So that's, for me, what it's all about. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also looking forward to August when we're planning a tour of Peru and Bolivia again with Brian Forrester and Gary Evans. Hopefully you'll be along this time, Gary, instead of sitting with your feet up back in Suffolk, wherever you're living. You're going to make it this time. Anyway, but for me, it'll be brilliant. It'll be a fantastic tour. We'll have a great time. Thank you.
Excellent. Sounds good. All right. Well, Brian, let's shift over to you again and see if there's something you want to add here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, definitely. I'm very much looking forward to it, again, because it's my first trip to Egypt. I've been fascinated, as most people are, from childhood. But I don't regard the tour as being a unique event, because since Chris has been here traveling with me, and I've received a lot of great information just from listening to him speak and watching him work. After this Egypt tour is over, I very much want to welcome Chris to come back whenever he wants to, but also Stephen to come to Peru and the Iwans to come to Peru, so that we can continue as the years go on of this sharing on location, this studying on location, and sharing our different disciplines with each other. And through things like YouTube or documentaries or whatever, then we can progressively share this with the 7 billion human beings that live on and share this planet and our history.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Really exciting. It's really what it's about, becoming bringing in the different disciplines on studies and try to see what the holistic picture is. And I think the more we do that, the better our understanding will become. It's a great idea. Okay, let's shift over to Patricia and Yusuf as well. Is there anything you guys want to talk about, either if there's something related to the tour or something with your own work or website? Please go ahead.
Well, first we want to thank Brian for the invitation. We'll take you up on that. I did want to also mention that the highlight of the tour will be our finale on the Giza Plateau, the private visits with between the paws of the Sphinx, who we call Tefnut. We'll have an hour and a half to spend walking around and being in the area down with Tefnut. And then that will be followed by 1.5 to 2 hours inside the Great Pyramid, nice. Privately, hopefully having the entire pyramid to ourselves with, hopefully, and this is our plan, to have all three chambers open for us to explore during this time. So we're really looking forward to the entire tour, which will be filled with surprises, and of course, sharing with all these wonderful speakers.
Indeed, sounds really good.
I want to thank Brian Forster and Chris Dunn for all the work they have done for the showing the similarity between Egypt and Peru. And also I want to thank Chris especially about the documentary he made for the Coral Castle. That was really fascinating. Also my brother Stephen and Gary. And we look forward to have you here, Brian. So... be ready.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Yusuf, as well. And I guess we'll wrap up with Gary here then again, and maybe you can give us the rundown, of course, on the basics in terms of where to turn to find out more, and if there's anything else you want to say, Gary.
Okay. Yeah, well, just sort of the best idea was to give a quick quote from a guest that's just returned home from our tour that I did with Yusuf and Patricia in December. Because it's very difficult to describe to people just how much of an impact it has, Egypt can have. And I never like to make any promises because we're all at different stages in our journey. We need different things. But this is a good example of the kind of responses that we get on quite a regular basis now. And so she said, my father saw me after my first spiritual Egypt visit and saw me after this one, meaning our December tour. The first time he noticed a difference, but this time he said, this time Egypt has changed you. He could not put it in any different words, but I know what he felt. He said, you are lighter. And a lot of what we were doing was kind of working through things, trauma that comes up in life. I mean, it's not an easy ride, so we'd certainly I could understand what she was saying in that message. And I think just finally another thought that she gave, and she said there's always more and much more to learn, and it's a matter of allowing. So the more we allow, the more will be taken and understood, and this is the choice.
Mm. Yeah, very good indeed. And of course, we don't want to forget the websites as well, Gary. We want to give out those again, but anything more you want to add to that?
Well, it's just heartwarming to be involved in tours that are having these profound effects, and there's nothing I'd rather be doing. I feel very lucky to do it, as we all do, hosting these tours. And the ancient sites around the world, however they work, they can help us along our path. And I think people have this deep inner knowing. They kind of feel pulled to different places. I'm a firm believer that Egypt isn't necessarily the solution for everybody. Perhaps they need Peru, or they know in themselves where they need to go. And I would certainly encourage anyone that has these kind of deep interests in certain locations to follow their heart, because it might well answer a few questions and lead them in the right direction. And I look forward to seeing some of the listeners in April. We're definitely going to have a fantastic journey. There's much to be said about a group of like-minded people coming together. Quite often we're in isolated parts of the world. Many of us aren't fortunate to have lots of sort of open-minded friends, so it's a real opportunity for sharing. And I think most of us end up with friends for life, because we have such deep experiences and share so much that we definitely stay in touch after the tour. And anyone that would like to get in touch with me again, I'm open to questions. It's not just about getting people onto the tours. I'm quite happy to help people with any questions or musings they may have. You can get in touch with me via my website, which is infinite-connections.co.uk. I do have another website, which is kind of about ancient mysteries and sort of evidence but there is probably an earlier chapter of human civilization, and that's AtlantisEvidence.com. You can also contact me through there. My Facebook group is Infinite Connections PR, all one word. And on Twitter, I'm Connections_PR. So yeah, look forward to hearing from people soon, and really appreciate you interviewing us all today, Henrik. Much appreciated.
Oh, definitely. You bet, Gary. Thank you. Great stuff. Very nice. And the websites will be up and available. All right, that's it. Very interesting stuff we've been talking about. Of course, we can only brush the surface of all these details. There is just so much, but it's always interesting to get a kind of a flavor of the chemistry, I guess, as well, between the different speakers and researchers that are going to be at the event. So again, Superior Technologies and Consciousness of the Ancients Tour. That's what this is about. I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for being generous with your time and sharing your insights with us. So I guess we can all at once say thanks and bye. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank everybody for listening.
All right, that's it. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Our next program, we have Danny Wilton with us to discuss Orion in the Vatican. We have many more coming up, including Robert Tindall, Russell Targ, Lynn Picknett, Randall Carlson, Josh Reeves, Mark Safer, Bill Donahue, and many more. You, of course, have our full list of upcoming guests in our radio archive on redicemembers.com. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth, and we will be back soon with more eye-opening, controversial, and essential radio. Thank you for staying with us. Have a good one.